You're tuned to The Drive on your 24/7 home of the Black and Gold, Steelers Nation Radio.
Welcome back to The Drive. I'm Dale Lally here with Matt Williamson. We're very, very pleased to be joined at this time by Bob Labriola, the editor of Steelers Digest at Steelers.com. Bob, it's been a while. We've seen you, but we haven't heard you on our airwaves since we changed studios here. We finally got the technology working here in our favor, and glad to have you on.
Well, you know, I told you, just change the diet for the hamsters that are running around in the cages on the wheels and powering all the equipment, and it would have been fine.
Bob, September 19th, 2004, we're in Baltimore. Tommy Maddox gets hurt. Ben Roethlisberger comes up, walks onto the field for the first time. Did you think 18 years later we'd still be talking about this guy?
And now I have 2 Super Bowl rings, too.
Not a coincidence.
I'll tell you what, it didn't take long to know that he was something special. I didn't know about 18 years, but, see, I'm not a scout or a coach or a football expert or anything, but for me, what really struck me was early on in that training camp, at the start of practices when it's like they call it individual period. And I remember that was the reestablishing the mindset summer. That's what Bill Cowher christened it after 2 years of the Tommy Maddox mistake, which is what I christened that. So they would have the quarterbacks, all doing the same thing as they worked on, fundamentals and that kind of stuff.
One of those things did not look like the others.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, it was so dramatic of a difference that I could recognize it. And I thought, wow, I mean, this guy is, I don't know how good he is, but I can see with my own eyes that he is better than anybody else out there right now.
Yeah. I can remember watching him go through drills, those drills that he did with Mark Whipple, who was the quarterback's coach at the time. And he's, sprint to your right at a full speed and throw, 15-yard out. Now do it to the left and do the same thing. Like, I'm watching this going, holy mackerel. Like,
this looks a little different than what I've been used to.
Yeah, this is a 6'5", 240-pound quarterback running way faster than, Tommy Maddox could, or me for that matter, and delivering the ball on the mark, every time.
Well, and let me say this, too. I really, really believe one of the critical elements, I don't wish anybody any harm, but something that really helped the Steelers and then was when Charlie Batch injured his knee and went on IR, because that made Ben the backup, because there wasn't anyone else there on the roster on the training camp roster at that time that you could put it in that job, even though the draft pick was a rookie and came from the MAC. He was still the number 2 guy that you had, and so he was kind of forced to be, coached as the backup, get backup reps in terms of being fourth on the depth chart, which he was, when camp opened, and it got him on the field with better players. Because I remember talking to one of the scouts, and, when it was time for Ben to go in, early in camp, I mean, he's out there with, all the undrafted rookie receivers and those kind of people, and, that's kind of a waste.
Yeah, the idea was not for him to play right away.
Yes, I was going
to
ask you to. I don't recall what the plan was.
He was supposed to be number 3 all season long.
Okay.
He was still 22 years old.
Right.
Yeah.
And
so
times are a little different.
One of the greatest coaching moves Bill Cowher ever made, he really didn't have a choice. Because, no, seriously, right, and again, I'm not disparaging him either. That's just the coaches, you know, that's the way they think. That's in their DNA. But imagine if when Maddox got hurt, they put in, again, I don't mean to disparage anybody, Charlie Batch. Mm-hmm. And so you're 8-8, maybe.
Maybe.
Right.
With a, yeah, with a roster that went 15-1.
Who knows how it goes.
Yeah.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of careers made, and you know, who knows if maybe Bill Cowher doesn't he's not in the Hall of Fame now, because maybe the Steelers don't win the Super Bowl in 2005 because Ben wasn't the backup when Maddox got hurt and they were forced to play him, you know. And as Alan Faneca told Jerry DePaula, no, I'm not excited to see what the rookie can do.
Well, the Steeler fans owe Gary Baxter a nod of thanks then.
Defensive back from the Ravens?
Gary Baxter sacked Tommy Maddox in the third quarter of that game, and Maddox fumbled and got hurt. And that
his shoulder, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was his shoulder, and that led to a touchdown by the Ravens that made it 20-0 at that time. And the next series, to your point, Bob, Deuce Daly run. Antoine Randall L run. Veron Haynes run. Steelers punt. He didn't throw a pass on his first NFL possession. And then his first pass, incomplete to Plexico Burress, intercepted by Adalius Thomas on his second pass. And then after that, it was okay. He was fine and completed 12 of his next 18 and a couple of touchdown passes, but yeah, it was not the smooth sailing for the rookie in his first game.
No, and then in his first start was the hurricane.
Right, down in Miami.
In Miami.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember, you know, where I was sitting, where they had the press box, or at least, you know, my part of the press box in whatever it was called at that time. Maybe it was still Joe Robbie Stadium, I don't know. But I was kind of close to the end zone, the corner, where Hines Ward caught the game-winning touchdown pass. And, you know, I remember, the thing I remember about it the most was, I kind of lost sight of the ball. And then, you know, I saw his arm go, and then I lost sight of the ball, and then the referee put his arms up, touchdown, and I thought, wow. You know, Hines made a really nice catch along the sideline in the end zone. And, you know, apparently, because of the fact that it was in such tight quarters, the ball had to be right on the money. And as I said, it came in with some velocity and obviously accuracy. And, you know, then I started, you know, talking to Ken Whisenhunt a little bit more often. And I remember a conversation he and I had after the sixth game of the year against Dallas down there. And I think it was 14 points the Steelers scored in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, that was his first career comeback.
Okay, there you go. So, and I just remember saying to Whisenhunt, I was like, wow, did you know this guy had whatever this is that he has? And then that just from there, it was one thing after another. I guess you just kind of eventually, gradually get used to him doing these kinds of things. And, you know, you can be impressed, but you're not surprised. And that's the way I kind of remember the rest of that, his rookie season.
Labs, I even mentioned this to you. I mean, that his rookie year was the year I was with the Browns. And so knowing that he was my hometown's quarterback and all that, I went and pillaged a bunch of the Browns scouting reports and read them all, you know, as Ben as a draftable prospect. And there's things in there, I don't remember what's in them, to be honest with you. I'm going to go look in my attic one of these nights real soon, and hopefully I can find them. But do you remember what the negatives were on him coming out of school compared to Eli and Rivers, except for small school? I think they held that against quarterbacks more 18 years ago than they do now.
Yeah, I remember him being billed as the least NFL-ready of the three.
And that was largely because of the offense that Miami ran. It was the offense now that everybody runs. You know, it was all shotgun,
yeah,
and he never was under center.
And his last name wasn't Manning.
Right.
Right, you know.
And you know, the other thing about him, and this isn't wasn't necessarily a negative, but you know, talking to some of the Steelers scouts who were employed back then, one of them relayed to me that they were in, you know, the watching film of him, and you know, he was doing what he did so often, you know, shrugging off tacklers, running around, and as you said, Dale, explaining that drill that Mark Whipple, the quarterback's coach, was putting them through, you know, running the one outside the one hash and throwing to the other side of the field on a rope. And somebody said, that looks like John Elway. And somebody else said, yeah, we'll never get a chance to pick him. but, you know, the Browns had to have the chosen one, and they picked Kellen Winslow Jr.
And there you go. It was a good draft class, too, and all. I mean,
and the other one maybe that's a little bit less well-known is Tom Donahoe was the GM in Buffalo at the time, and he desperately wanted Roethlisberger, and he tried to trade in the Jacksonville spot. I believe they were ninth.
They were ninth, yeah. They took Reggie Williams.
Right. The football player with the basketball player's name, because I don't know a football player named Reggie Williams ever. I can name you a couple of basketball players.
He had 189 career catches and 18 touchdowns.
Yeah. I mean, I remember nobody was shocked he went that high, though. I honestly, I remember giving Larry a hard time saying, Reggie Williams is going to go ahead of you. Of course he didn't. But that was a good draft class. I mean, they benefited from having a really strong first half of the first draft, you know, of the first round.
Well, that sounds like scout speak to me, because Reggie, you cannot convince me that Reggie Williams was worthy of being drafted where he was.
Well, he was a bust. I mean, but nobody batted an eye when he went, is my point.
Okay.
I'd rather have been.
It still doesn't excuse Cleveland, which did not have a quarterback for 20-plus years, passing on.
Well, I know there's logic franchise behind quarterback. It from being there. It doesn't mean it's right.
To pick a tight end.
Right.
A tight end.
That's enough right there just to make your head spin.
To paraphrase what Dan Mooney said to me about wide receivers, tight ends should have to buy a ticket to get into the game. Especially in that era. You know, tight ends now have evolved, and, you know, they offensive coordinators are in love with them and all the different things they can do and, you know, whatever. But, I mean, at that time, the position was just not that important that you would pick one sixth, right? Sixth?
It was either five or six.
He was six, yeah. They actually swapped spots with Washington.
And they traded up to get a two.
They knew they were going to get Sean Taylor or Winslow, who Butch coached in college, and that was the logic behind it, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, if you look at that draft, Eli Manning went first, then
Gallery.
To the Chargers, and then got traded. Robert Gallery, Larry Fitzgerald went third. Mm-hmm. Rivers went fourth to the Giants. People forget about that.
Then right.
Those guys got swapped. Then it was Sean Taylor to Washington, Kellen Winslow at six to Cleveland. Detroit took Roy Williams, mm-hmm. D'Angelo Hall at eight.
There's another bust receiver pick.
He had 393 catches. He wasn't awful. But he wasn't Ben Roethlisberger.
Right. I mean, all these teams were not taking Ben.
D'Angelo Hall, then Reggie Williams. Dante Robinson went to the Houston Texans, and then the Steelers with the 11th pick in the draft take quarterback Ben Roethlisberger from Miami of Ohio.
One of the and this is more of a this probably will amuse me more than you guys or your listeners, but – you want me on, you're not paying me, so you got to listen to me.
Bring it on.
At the draft, it was in New York at the time. At least the Steelers' philosophy to who got sent, you know, to be in New York and sit at the table and hand in the index cards were two people who it was assumed would not be needed at team headquarters, Heinz Field at that point, the South Side. It wasn't the UPMC Rooney Sports Complex yet, but we just called it the South Side. That's the practice facility, you know, where they still are. And the two guys they came up with were Tim Carey, who was the head of merchandise, who I grew up with, and Scott Phelps, who was the they didn't even call him an IT guy then, because really, I don't even know if there was a Steelers.com there then, and if there was, it was nothing like it is now. And so those were the two guys that sat at the table. So, as I said, I grew up with Tim Carey, and so I know what an awful speller he was through grade school and high school. So right before they left, and I was just looking through the names, and I saw Roethlisberger, and I said, well, that's the most complicated spelling assignment that I could come up with. So I called him on the phone, and he answered, they hadn't left yet. And I said, hey, I know you're a lousy speller. You've been a lousy speller your whole life. I said, memorize this one.
Write this one on your hand or something. Yeah.
Right. Roethlisberger. Lisberger. And we ended up picking him. But that was just a guess. But anyway, in his basement, I won't call it a man cave, but, you know, down there in his house, he got a picture because they brought the number one picks at the time over to the tables, you know, where the team representative sat, for a picture. So Tim is shaking our number one pick's hand at the time. Ben ended up signing it for him, and this is what he wrote on it. Tim, thanks so much for drafting me, Ben Roethlisberger. And I told him, I said, you got to keep that in a very prominent space because except for the people who work with you, no one knows how totally immaterial you were that entire process. And here you are getting credit for it. That's the greatest thing ever.
That's the guy to give all the credit for. Absolutely. That's how it happened.
Should pat Scott Phelps on the shoulder, too, when they see him at the facility.
Thanks for not misspelling my name on the index card.
And not tripping on the way up to the podium.
No, they have runners for that. I mean, they don't even trust those guys. Right, just hand it to them.
Bob, when do you remember it becoming Ben's team, Ben's offense, you know, making those around him better, you know, realizing maybe you can cut a corner at offensive line because you have this stud quarterback? Like, how long did that take?
Not very long.
I bet.
Because, and justifiably so, this version of the offensive line is criticized. And I don't know that 2008 version was any better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Justin Hartwig, Max Starks was a legitimate player. Darnell Stapleton.
Ooh.
Who was the other guard?
I get it.
Faneca.
No, Faneca was gone. Right? Faneca was gone by 08.
Oh, that's right. Faneca was gone. Darnell Stapleton, Ramon Foster wasn't there yet.
Right,
probably not. Yeah.
Was Willie Colon was
Willie
one
Colon
of the guys.
Was on that team? He might have been the right tackle. It was
enough said that we can't remember though. Yeah, you know, I mean,
I could,
a bunch
I,
of dudes.
I can look it up here real quick.
I got it.
I got it right here too.
Max Starks, left tackle. Chris Kimoyatu, left guard. Hartwig at center. Stapleton at right guard and Willie Colon at right tackle was the starting offensive line in Super Bowl 43.
Yeah.
And he was under a lot of pressure that year.
Yeah. And you've seen the tweet, or it's a video clip when they handed Ben, because I was standing down on the field, when they handed Ben the Lombardi, he said something like, "Hey, O-line, who's laughing now?" Those were his first words, because the offensive line got hammered that whole season. And the media fans were not big fans either of that particular position group. But, I mean, Ben, you know, as being a leader and being, you know, those guys being his guys, and it didn't take long. What was he, fourth year? When the first words out of his mouth after getting the being handed the Lombardi Trophy, after leading that drive down the field, winning the game, that says something to me in terms of how he interacted with his teammates. And I don't know that there's any position closer to the quarterback than the offensive lineman, because even more than the wide receivers who catch his passes, the offensive linemen who at least attempt to keep him alive, I would imagine they're the closest in terms of spending time and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, they did give up 49 sacks that season, and the team averaged 3.7 yards per rushing attempt.
Ooh.
It was not
a, not a juggernaut so, front there. Huh?
Yeah, I mean, there were some things that you could look at there and say, well, this is a problem. But he covered it up.
That was the beauty of it.
He covered it up. And I still insist to this day, if Peyton Manning or Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers or pick a quarterback, I don't care who it is, throws that pass in that spot to Santonio Holmes, they are the Super Bowl MVP, not instead of Santonio Holmes.
Oh, I said that to leaving the press box to go down to the field after the game. Peter King and Ron Jaworski were standing there talking. And I said, you guys going to tell me that if Peyton Manning or Tom Brady just did what Roethlisberger did, you guys give the MVP to the receiver who caught the pass? I got no answer.
Yeah, so there's not a good response for that one.
There really isn't. Yeah, I to this day, I say that. And it's nothing against Santonio Holmes. He had a great game.
No, right. But always goes to the quarterback.
That was a great catch.
It was a great catch, he got him down. You know, he was a key cog in that Super Bowl win. But they don't get there with just, you know, Joe Slappy playing quarterback.
No.
Well, and the other one, I remember saying to some of the media who I believe, you know, became card-carrying members of the Peyton Manning fan club years before. And this was in the RCA Dome. As I was leaving the press box and going downstairs, and I said, you know, you guys all tell me that Peyton Manning's the greatest quarterback in the league. You think he makes that tackle?
Yeah.
You think he gets that guy on the ground and saves that game?
It's funny, Labs. Oh. For the last week or two, I've been asked often, so, you know, what are the Steelers going to look at the quarterback position, and are guys like Ben a dinosaur? And I would always ask, you know, what do you mean guys like Ben a dinosaur? And they'd always say, you know, the pocket passers that don't move around real well. I'm like, go back and YouTube most of his career.
Right.
I mean, he's a Josh Allen-like specimen who slowed down late in life, as everyone does, but by no means is him as a prospect a dinosaur. It's the other way around. He was ahead of his time physically to me.
I've seen a video that was uploaded, somebody like put combined it or whatever, you know, Ben being Ben, they called it. And I was teasing Max Starks because, you know, it was when Ben was shrugging off pass rushers and running around, and you know, you could see Max in a lot of them, you know, trying to find somebody to block a lot of times because, you know, you'd think you had a guy lined up, and then all of a sudden Ben would reverse field and then you're chasing him again. You're trying to chase a guy to find somebody to block. And, you know, I believe you would have been there, Dale. One of the best plays of Ben Roethlisberger's career was in the 2010 regular season game in Baltimore against the Ravens.
Yeah.
When he somehow avoided a sack by Terrell Suggs, who had him wrapped up.
He just stiff-armed him off, like –
Stiff-armed him off and wiggled free and got his right arm with the ball out enough to throw it away. And I believe it was the next play was fourth down. He threw it, Ben threw a touchdown pass to Isaac Redman.
Yeah.
And then what that meant was the divisional round playoff game was in Pittsburgh instead of Baltimore. I believe that was a significant difference because for so many of those years, I thought that the Ravens and the Steelers were the two best teams, if not just the AFC, maybe in the NFL. Nobody can convince me that the 2008 Ravens, if they were in the NFC, it would have been Steelers-Ravens in that game. Because, you know, John Madden once famously misspoke and said in 1974, after the Raiders beat the two-time defending champion Dolphins, in the divisional round. You know, this was the Super Bowl. And, you know, Chuck Noll used that as a little bit of a motivating tool, maybe for the only time in his life. But if somebody said after the 2008 AFC Championship game, this was the Super Bowl, I don't think anybody would have argued.
Yeah, those games were unbelievable.
Yes.
And
so,
acts of violence.
My understanding is, just another little quick story, but all that stuff was legal at the time, too. In the final Steelers team meeting before that 2008 AFC Championship game, one of the last things Mike Tomlin told the team was, the most violent team tomorrow will win. And that's the kind of game it was.
They were.
And they built their teams for that reason.
That's why it's kind of fitting that Roethlisberger will end things Sunday in Baltimore, where it all started, really. Everything comes full circle there. Bob, we got to let you go. We could sit here and talk Roethlisberger. Well, not for 18 years, but certainly for the next 18 hours. But we don't want to keep you that long. I appreciate you stopping by. It was great to have you on the show here. We got to let you go. He is Matt Williamson. I'm Dale Lally. You're listening to The Drive here on Steelers Nation Radio. We'll be back with more right after this.